I had originally planned to give an overview of the structure of the dissertation argument. However, on reflection, I thought that this might be repetitious in that you've just completed a reading of the full text. I believe that it may be more valuable to examine, from a slightly different perspective to that used in the dissertation, that which may be its most contentious aspect, namely, what I termed the crossing of the disciplinary threshold. By this phrase, I meant the incorporation of problematic aspects of psychiatric diagnosis and treatment into the philosophical analysis. It is necessary to make some points of clarification. Firstly, this crossing of the threshold is a highly circumscribed crossing into at most what might be termed the anteroom of psychiatry. It does not stray beyond published reports and journal articles. It does not trespass onto the area of psychiatrists' professional expertise. It is, I suggest, little different from the analysis that might be undertaken by a historian of psychiatry into the evidence base for some psychiatric treatments and of the possibility of their causing harm, or similar investigations that might be made by a trial lawyer or by a health economist. Secondly, this crossing is one aspect of a larger and much more important question, namely, what stance should the philosophy of psychiatry adopt vis-à-vis psychiatry? Should it seek to be a buttress or to be a critic? Should it be deferential or should it seek to actively uncover problematic aspects of psychiatric theory and practice? This question might be rephrased as, does the philosophy of psychiatry owe its allegiance to philosophy or to psychiatry? I wish to briefly examine this question in the light of the analysis made by Professor Fulford into problematic aspects of Soviet psychiatry, with particular emphasis on his recommendations for modern Western psychiatry. But before doing this, some comments made by the philosopher and sociologist Gillian Rose in relation to modern attitudes towards the Holocaust help set the stage for examining Fulford's views. Gillian Rose was professor of social and political thought at Warwick University. She was Jewish and had been deeply involved in Holocaust studies. Gillian Rose had argued that the Holocaust was being narrated now in such a way as to protect the present generation from the thought that they too might have something in common with the perpetrators of the Holocaust. For Rose, the story of the Holocaust is typically told so as to place the audience alongside the victim. For example, in discussing the film Schindler's List, she uses the term Holocaust piety to describe the responses to the film, which she states, quotes, seeks to mystify something we dare not understand, because we fear that it may be all too understandable, all too human, end of quotes. The film, she states, degenerates into myth and sentimentality and, quotes, it leaves us piously joining the survivors, putting stones on Schindler's grave. It should leave us unsafe, end of quotes. Rose contrasts Schindler's List with the film of Kazuo Ishiguro's novel The Remains of the Day and with Tadeusz Borowski's text This Way for the Gas, Ladies and Gentlemen. Concerning The Remains of the Day, she states, quotes, instead of emerging with sentimental tears, which leave us emotionally and politically intact, we emerge with the dry eyes of a deep grief, which belongs to the recognition of our ineluctable grounding in the norms of the emotional and political culture which was represented, end of quotes. Concerning Borowski, she states, quotes, he makes you witness the brutality in the most disturbing way, for it is not clear from what position, as whom, you are reading. You emerge shaking in horror, at yourself, with yourself in question. End of quotes. Rose's comments are relevant as to how we should regard the practice of medicine, and in particular psychiatry, in Nazi Germany and in the USSR. Do we accept the comfortable illusion that these aberrations were sui generis and accordingly of no relevance to modern bioethical debates, or do we fully acknowledge their continuing ethical relevance? However, my main concern here is with Soviet psychiatry, and in particular with how it was and is now generally perceived in the West, especially as to its presumed singularity and radical incompatibility with psychiatry as practiced in the West. Modern Western attitudes appear to revolve around two main themes. Firstly, that Soviet psychiatry was not as science-based as is modern psychiatry. And secondly, that Soviet psychiatry allowed itself to be used as a mechanism for the suppression of political dissidents. A flavour of these perceptions is to be found in a British Medical Journal editorial from 1986, which began, quotes, "It is considered by some governments that if a person does not agree with the views of the state, his sanity must be called into question. Extensive documentation exists on the misuse of psychiatry and psychiatric drugs in the Soviet Union." End of quotes. I wish to mention three commentaries which draw a very sharp distinction between Soviet psychiatry and psychiatry as practiced in the West. I do this to draw attention not to the more obvious points concerning the deficiencies in Soviet psychiatric practice, but to the picture of Western psychiatric practice that is implicit, a picture in which it appears inconceivable that the deficiencies in Soviet psychiatric practice under discussion could occur in Western psychiatric practice. The first is from the Irish Supreme Court of 2009, which argued that the Mental Health Act of 2001, quotes, "is a scheme of protection and a very elaborate and very necessary scheme of protection because, of course, everyone, even from general knowledge, is aware of the serious misuse of the power to detain people in mental hospitals which have taken place in fairly recent times in other jurisdictions." End of quotes. And again, quotes, "we do not feel called upon by authority or otherwise to apply to this case the sort of reasoning that would be applied if it were a criminal detention." End of quotes. A disinterested observer might have thought that the application of such a form of reasoning would be the most effective preventative against abuse. Two other commentaries are from academic psychiatrists who have written extensively on Soviet psychiatric practice. The first, Block and Rodway, quotes, "The prospect of being placed compulsory in a psychiatric hospital as a healthy person is so ghastly as to be almost unimaginable." End of quotes. And again, quotes, "added to this frightening insecurity is the sense of complete impotence experienced by the dissenter. Not only is he deprived of the right to judicial review, but he has no legal redress whatever concerning any aspect of his conditions. For example, he cannot mount a malpractice suit against a cruel staff member." End of quotes. Yet, as history has shown, for example, the recent primetime documentary on Radio Television on Hannah Greely, this is a situation in which many Irish psychiatric patients have found themselves. And the last quote is by Mirsky and Shafran, who state, quotes, "It is common for English writers to consider that at least 20% of the general population may have a psychiatric disorder. But these are self-disclosed symptoms and complaints, not disorders which the patient himself rejects and which his relatives may also reject." End of quotes. This appears to minimize both the use in Western psychiatry of coercion and also in relation to psychiatric attitudes towards denial. A further quote from Mirsky and Shafran, quotes, "When a psychiatric system places such emphasis on latent illness, which is not detectable by our usual open techniques, it involves immeasurable risks to the liberty of the individual." End of quotes. This is an assertion which is very difficult to reconcile with studies as the such as the Hinkling study of 1999. Before summarizing Fulford's analysis of Soviet psychiatry, I would like to refer to a recently published book by Jonathan Metzl, published in 2009. He is an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Michigan. Metzl provides some surprising confirmation of Gillian Rose's contention that we should be open to noticing the mote in our own eyes before too readily distancing ourselves from aberrant practices of a past era or of another place. Metzl's book is entitled The Protest Psychosis: How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. Metzl notes that prior to the civil rights era, mainstream American psychiatric and public opinion generally regarded schizophrenia as a disease of the white middle classes and as generally harmless to society. He writes, quotes, "Schizophrenia's transformation from an illness of white feminine docility to one of black male hostility resulted from a confluence of social and medical forces," end of quotes. Among the factors that he lists are the publication of the DSM-II in 1968 at a time of great social unrest, which he states, quotes, "recast the paranoid subtype of schizophrenia as a disorder of masculinized belligerence," end of quote. And, quotes, "growing numbers of research articles from the 1960s and 1970s asserted that schizophrenia was also a condition that affected Negro men and that black forms of the illness were more aggressive and hostile than were white ones," end of quotes. One such influential article published in 1968 in the Archives of General Psychiatry was entitled The Protest Psychosis, a Special Type of Reactive Psychosis. The opening sentence of this article is, quotes, "The purpose of this paper is to identify a specific type of reactive psychosis related in part to recent sociopolitical events," end of quotes. This article linked the Black Power movement to the rise in delusions, hallucinations, and violent projections among black men. Metzl describes how advertisements in the psychiatric journals for antipsychotic medications such as Haldol showed angry black men or even just African tribal symbols. He notes that, quotes, "mainstream white newspapers in the 1960s and 70s described schizophrenia as a condition of angry black masculinity or warned of crazed black schizophrenic killers on the loose," end of quotes. As I mentioned in the main dissertation, a similar transformation occurred in British psychiatry. Butcher, for example, quotes, "when the Mental Act was introduced in 1983, psychiatrists believed that there was no association between mental illness and violence. It was Jonathan Zito's murder that changed the practice of psychiatry in the UK, according to Anthony Madden," end of quotes. Returning now to take up the theme of the suggested radical incompatibility between Soviet and Western psychiatric practices, I wish to summarize Fulford's views, which are more nuanced than those of the commentators mentioned earlier. Fulford is dismissive of those who believe that any deficiencies in Soviet psychiatry were due to not sufficiently grounded in science. He states, quotes, "Soviet concepts of disease, far from being defined socially, were if anything more exclusively and explicitly biological than their counterparts in the West," end of quotes. Some of his other conclusions, in relation to particular diagnostic categories such as sluggish schizophrenia, he notes, quotes, "each has its counterpart in the West. Patients diagnosed in Moscow as suffering from sluggish schizophrenia were not found to be normal by Western criteria, but were reallocated to other disease categories," end of quotes. And, quotes, "the category of sluggish schizophrenia is similar to the Western concept of latent schizophrenia," end of quotes. In relation to reformist delusions, he states, quotes, "the symptom has been criticized for its political content, but in Western psychiatry, delusions with a political theme are common in a wide variety of mental conditions," end of quotes. Fulford's most important conclusion in relation to the present context relates to the concept of disease. Quotes, "diagnosis in medicine depends not just on the facts, but on the interpretation that is placed on the facts. medical sociologists have long argued that lay concepts of disease are value-laden, end of quote. But, quotes, the evaluative connotations even of all-purpose value terms such as good and bad vary with context. For a non-medical example, good, used of pictures, has overtly evaluative connotations, whereas used of, for instance, apples, its connotations are mainly descriptive. Transferring this argument to medicine, then, it can be seen that if disease is a value term, physical illness would be like good when used of apples, while mental illness would be like good used of pictures, end of quotes. And again, quotes, but this means that it is in just these cases in which the value judgments are genuinely contentious, that an open and explicit framework for diagnosis is required. The lesson from the Soviet experience, therefore, is that it is by exposing our practice to the marketplace of free exchange of ideas, rather than by sheltering behind an exclusively scientific model of disease, that we can help to reduce the vulnerability of psychiatry to abuse. End of quotes. Fulford's conclusion reinforces that of the Swedish sociologist Gunnar Olofsson, which is discussed in the conclusions to the dissertation, who highlighted the importance of countervailing forces in relation to professions such as psychiatry. One such countervailing force is the philosophy of psychiatry, provided that it adopts the mantle of critic and not of apologist. The conclusion that I wish to draw is that the philosophy of psychiatry owes its allegiance solely and unreservedly to philosophy rather than psychiatry. Thank you.